Hi everyone, welcome back to Historical Friction, a podcast about retelling the past and framing the present through pop culture. I'm Alice Proctor, I'm a writer and art historian, and my guest for this episode is a return visitor. Nicole Cochrane is a dear friend of mine and a huge fan of the subject of today's film, so obviously I had to get her to discuss it with me. We talked about a film that's variously referred to as Emma Hamilton or That Hamilton Woman. It's released in 1941, and it's a very weird bit of costume, romance, historical war propaganda, starring Vivian Leigh and Laurence Olivier. We discussed the representation of Emma Hamilton as a beauty icon of the day, and particularly the ways that her story resonates in our modern understanding of women who are famous for their appearance, the power that they hold, and the ways that they are allowed or prevented from expressing it. As always, you can find the show on Twitter at History Friction, and we're also on Patreon as Historical Friction if you want to give us a hand. We have a couple of new patrons on there, and I'm so, so grateful to you for helping us out. Please, if you don't want to give us money, leave a nice review wherever you get your podcasts and do whatever you can to make your family friends listen to the show. Here it is. Hi, Nicole. Thank you so much for joining me. Would you like to introduce yourself and tell people what film we watched today?
I'd love to. So I am Nicole Cochrane. I am a former podcast attendee and big fan always. I'm an art historian and museum professional. I work largely on the history of art collecting and antiquities in the 18th and 19th century. And we watched That Hamilton Woman / Lady Hamilton, the 1941 British period drama about the life of Emma Hamilton and her relationship primarily with Horatio Nelson.
This film was kind of unhinged in so many ways. So it's a Vivian Leigh and Laurence Olivier historical drama. And at the time they were actually married, they had just got married. And so I think it's their first appearance like as an on-screen couple. They did a lot of stage together. But so much of this film is clearly a vehicle for their relationship in a way that is really, really funny.
Yeah, and it's kind of wonderful because like they're one of those couples that you could absolutely tell that they were like deeply in love with each other at the time, because like they have so much chemistry and like these like romance scenes are just like so built for the two of them, and like they're two of just the most beautiful people that have like ever existed, and so just having them like just lovingly look at each other is so wonderful.
It's fantastic. Who was Emma Hamilton? So this is, I know, a subject that you really love, and I also am just really fascinated by Emma Hamilton, and I've talked about her like in my work, and I know that you've done some work around her as well. Can you give us a quick biography for people who are less devoted?
Yeah, I think we are probably two of the biggest presidents of the Emma Hamilton fan club. Hamheads, as I've christened ourselves. So she's kind of a woman that defies a lot of biography, I guess, because so much has been said about her during her lifetime, very much of it not her own words. So the brief of it is that she was a woman who was born in very much the lower classes. I think her father was a blacksmith, her mother was a servant. She moves to London very young, very quickly becomes this kind of, I guess, courtesan figure, and very much gets passed around London circles. She has a number of lovers, notably Charles Greville, who kind of promises her marriage and never does. He then passes her off to his uncle, who is envoy in Naples. So she goes to Naples and she kind of defies a lot of what people expected, becomes William Hamilton, who is the envoy in Naples, his husband. So she goes from being this lower class courtesan to being Lady Hamilton, envoy to the Neapolitan court. Notably, while she's there, she then meets Horatio Nelson, who is obviously this British heroic figure, and they have this kind of tumultuous love affair. Sadly, after William Hamilton and Nelson both die, she dies very much in penury. She dies in France, very poor, tragically. And her life has kind of been told in this very dramatic way, because so much of her life was so dramatic that she had this kind of spectacular rise and spectacular fall. She's kind of captivated people since she was alive. And I think everyone, even if you don't know her story, most people will have seen her face, because she became very much this idea of British beauty in the 18th century. One description I read of her described her as being like an English rose with some petals crumpled.
she is beautiful, and like she's beautiful in a way that's very particular to the standards of the time. She has this kind of very delicate features. She's quite fair with a very round face, round eyes, small mouth. And she has a particular kind of feistiness about her that makes her really interesting as an artist model, as well as all of these other things. And so her career and kind of life has these different eras in a really remarkable way. She seems to start out as a servant. She's almost certainly a sex worker in a kind of fairly straightforward capacity at one point. She then is sort of a professional mistress to all of these kind of wealthy and powerful men, and goes from there to this incredibly powerful, like, public figure, and then ends in obscurity. And so often her life is described kind of in terms of the relationships that she's in at the time. And so she's kind of with Charles, then she's with Hamilton, and then she's with Nelson, mm-hmm. and these kind of men define the different eras of her life. But she is such a fascinating person, and the paintings of her by George Romney are really famous, really, really beautiful, like incredible collaboration between mm-hmm. the two of them as the sort of artist and subject. And it's clear that she had a lot of like artistic creativity and drive for herself, that she becomes kind of like a performance artist for a while when she's in Naples. She performs these attitudes based on William Hamilton's collections of sculptures and vases. And, you know, historically that's been attributed entirely to him as this thing of like, well, he must have been directing her. But we know that even before they met, she was doing very similar kinds of performances in London. She has this kind of history as a performer. And so there seems to be like a huge amount of input from her in that role that she doesn't necessarily get credit for.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And also there's the really interesting thing that the kind of sexist thing that she couldn't possibly have known about the classics and all these things, that's why William right. Hamilton must have directed her. But yeah, it ignores the fact that she's acting out these classical scenes from this early period with Romney, and when she's acting in London, like, how can she possibly have known about these things? But like this information is available to those. And especially if you're circulating with, I mean, the men that she was like involved with, people like Harry Fanshawe and Charles Greville, were massive antiquarians. These people knew massive amounts. So it just seems remarkable to me that people think that she possibly couldn't have known this when that information was there and the people that she was circulating with knew it, that she obviously would have gained this knowledge, especially now then when she's living in Naples with William Hamilton. There are accounts of her going to these archaeological sites with William Hamilton. Like, she would have taken this information. She learns French and Italian while she's in Naples. Mm. She's clearly a very intelligent woman, and clearly throughout her life knew how to use her intelligence and how to develop her intelligence in certain things. And yet this idea that she kind of becomes like an actress and a performer, she's done her whole life. She learns singing, she learns acting. Like, she's the best.
She's such a cool character and such a fascinating person. This film is focused primarily on her relationship with Nelson. And it begins with her arrival in Naples, which is done in a really interesting way. There is this kind of, well, the film actually has this sort of framing narrative of the elderly Emma telling her story to this random English woman that she's met when she's been arrested for stealing alcohol in France. And so we start with this kind of image of her downfall, and we know that there's going to be a bad ending. And she tells this woman that she's Emma Hamilton, and the woman doesn't believe her because, you know, Lady Hamilton was the most beautiful woman alive. There's no way that you could be her. And it's like, this is very clearly Vivian Leigh with some eye bags drawn on.
Yes,
like, she doesn't look old. She doesn't look haggard.
It's very different from like the actual descriptions of when she was living in France, because she obviously succumbed to drink quite a lot. One of the kind of endless things that she was mocked for in the press was that she put on weight in her later years. Whereas Vivian Leigh still looks very glamorous with some slight disheveled makeup on is quite funny. Yeah. It's also the fact that like, so this film, because it was filmed in the 1940s, it had to be censored. And because this film is entirely about a love affair, the book ending of her downfall was to kind of put a spin, because it's never actually negative about Nelson and Emma, even though it's about two people cheating on their spouses effectively. So this framing of it being about her downfall is purposely so that it would avoid these kind of censors.
I hadn't thought of that, but that makes total sense. Okay, that's so interesting. Yeah, that you have to show the consequences right off the bat so that you're not seen to be condoning this love affair. And yet, within that bracket, they are so very obviously presenting this as like a great romance. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay. So we then see Emma arriving in Naples, and we see her meeting William Hamilton for the first time. And he's taking a delivery of art and, you know, paintings and sculptures and antiquities and things that have been sent to him by his nephew, Charles Greville, in London. And amongst this cartload of objects emerges Emma Hart, as she is then, with her mother, who is a hilarious recurring character throughout the film and brought me so much joy. But what they do is this really kind of very clever thing where they show Sir William unveiling this painting of Emma, and it's very clearly an altered version of the George Romney painting to put Vivien Leigh's face on it, which I love and respect.
But actually a really good version. Kind of, like, it looks great. It looks really like an 18th century painting. Whereas, like, sometimes these films will do this and they look really shit.
Yeah. No, this was much more accurate than a lot of the, like, contemporary versions of this kind of thing that I've seen in other films and stuff. It was great. I always love a bit of this. And she kind of emerges dressed almost identical to the painting. And it's such a clever moment to be like, oh yes, the artwork has come to life. Which is a kind of recurring theme of her and Sir William's relationship, is that he collects sculptures and art and he falls in love with her painting before he even meets her, and he's kind of obsessed with her as an aesthetic object. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a really interesting thread running through the film.
Yeah, this idea that William Hamilton is Pygmalion and Emma Hamilton is Galatea is something that kind of happens during their lifetime and is discussed a lot. And it's the thing that kind of gets, I guess, William Hamilton is mostly criticised for, I guess, in like satirical prints and things, is this idea that he's like invented his wife, is really interesting. And the thing that surprised me a lot is, considering this film is filmed in 1940s, it actually goes in very well. Like, the way it discusses this is actually really good. Like, this introducing of Emma, of this kind of fictionalized portrait, and then William's talking to the French ambassador and says, no one looks like this. The French ambassador says, no woman looks like this. No woman has this perfect complexion. And then she emerges, kind of goes to show that our kind of idea of Emma is entirely invented by art, and that she's so dictated by these kind of principles. And also this idea that even William Hamilton kind of sees her as an object. Is actually, I was surprised at how well it shows that she kind of was regarded as being another part of his collection, that he kind of collected her by having her shipped to Naples.
Yeah, and that's something that comes up again and again throughout the film, and it's mostly used as a way of emphasizing the fact that he's like a disconnected husband and he doesn't love her or care about her, and it's used to sort of emphasize the romance of Nelson. But it is an interesting detail to me that they're taking this thing that is kind of like historically very well documented, that people saw her as part of his collection. Whether he saw her that way, there's kind of room for negotiation, but to take that and make it such a kind of emphatic part of their relationship right from the beginning. And when they have dinner together and she finds out that Charles is never coming back and he's not going to marry her after all, and she's devastated, he sort of walks her through his sculpture gallery and talks about how she's going to be the most beautiful object in his collection. And it's really sinister.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting thing because, I mean, we don't know for sure, but it does seem that she at least was affectionate towards William Hamilton. Like, they do seem to have had, if not a loving relationship, a very respectful one. She writes, I mean, after she ends up, she writes to Charles Greville quite a lot after she moves to Naples, and she's always really complimentary of him. She was like 20, he was like 60. So yeah. As a romantic relationship, probably not. I mean, they almost certainly did have a sexual relationship. But yeah, it's interesting how it takes that tactic of, we need to kind of portray William Hamilton negatively in order to make it seem like this is why she would have an affair with Nelson.
Yeah, rather than letting her just be a woman who has sexual desires.
Mm-hmm.
Because so much of her kind of dialogue is emphasizing the fact that she's a good woman now, and she's had this kind of complicated past. She may have had a child before she came to Naples. There's all sorts of questions about her sexual history and things like that, and it's kind of widely known and discussed at the time. And so she's really emphasizing the fact that she's now, you know, she's a good woman now, and she wants to be a proper lady, mm-hmm. and she wants to, you know, have her kind of new life. And she's never really allowed to get away from that. But by having William Hamilton as this kind of completely asexual character, it justifies slightly more, I assume, kind of in the eyes of the censors, the idea that she would then have a sexual relationship with a married man. And it makes sense from a narrative point of view, but it does also put their relationship in a really weird and interesting light, that he never sort of respects her as a person. He only ever sees her as an object,
mm-hmm.
which is very different to the historical truth, but serves this narrative function.
Yeah, there's this funny, very slightly heavy-handed metaphor that they make. So William opens this bust of Diana, which is clearly the Diana of Versailles, which is not a very good, it doesn't look like an ancient sculpture at all. It looks like something out of a garden center. No. But he kind of talks to this French ambassador and says, oh, look at this beautiful object. It isn't made any less beautiful by being held by many owners and having been, kind of, he makes a metaphor of it, like dirt being rubbed off of it. And it's
cast down into the mud.
Yeah, it's this such like heavy-handed metaphor of like her being kind of lifted out of being a sex worker to being his wife. That I kind of see why they've done it, but it's, yeah, it's very, very kind of clunky. But again, this is the 1940s. So of course they're going to kind of make these metaphors in a slightly less pointed way. Yeah.
And this is not a subtle film at all. Like, it's continually very, very heavy handed. But before we move on, I just want to talk about one kind of extra thing that comes out in this early stage of her relationship with William Hamilton, which is that she has this real interest in learning. And right from the beginning, she's shown to be like desperate to learn about the world. And, you know, they see Vesuvius out the window and she's really excited about the idea that she's going to learn all these languages and see all these places. And I thought that was a really interesting thing as well, to show her as this kind of, as a student, really. But also, it's one of the ways that you can add to the idea of her as a chameleon and as someone who sort of picks up the world around her in a really interesting way.
Yeah, she kind of, and I think this is the reason why Vivien Leigh is kind of perfect for this, because, I mean, you see this in like all of her other films, where she very much is good at towing this line between like childlike curiosity and also like something more kind of calculated. Well, calculated is probably the wrong word, but something that's purposeful. And I mean, this is her whole kind of shtick in Gone with the Wind, is this idea that, I mean, Gone with the Wind is filmed 2 years before this, this idea that she kind of is simultaneously this like childlike innocence, but also something that is more smart, and there's something more substantial to it, which I think kind of works for Emma Hamilton really perfectly, because she clearly, I mean, one of the things that a lot of people talk about in a lot of literature about Emma Hamilton was that she kind of had this desire to please people, that she wanted to be a lot of things for a lot of people. And I don't know if I agree with that. I think that she knew that she had to be a lot of things to a lot of people, and she very much could be different things in different scenarios. That I think, yeah, I think the film does very well in casting Vivien Leigh for it. I don't know if I ever would see someone playing Emma Hamilton other than Vivien Leigh, because I think she's just very perfect in the role.
Yeah, she's great in the role. She doesn't look like Emma, but she does a really good job. She doesn't look like the portraits. The portraits are all about this kind of very round face, soft features, fair hair and fair colouring. And Vivien Leigh has, you know, very dark features. She's very striking. She's quite angular. And they don't look alike, but she captures the sort of energy and I guess attitude of the character really effectively. And so in this moment when she's looking at the volcano with her mother and she's talking about how she knows all these little facts that she's picked up, she says, it's knowing little things like that that makes you a lady. And it's such a great line for this character, and such a like smart way of immediately presenting her as someone who, yeah, wants to please people, but also wants to learn and kind of improve herself and improve her status, which is one of the recurring themes in the way that Emma's represented, is this idea that she's a social climber.
Yeah, and I love that her mother is kind of always there to show that she's not the upper class.
Yeah.
Because the funny thing about the film that I think when I watch it is that, like, Vivian Leigh cannot do a common accent. Like, that woman had an upper class English accent her entire life. And one of the main things that Emma was kind of criticized for during her lifetime was that she was beautiful until she opened her mouth. Like, that was the thing that everyone said, that she couldn't kind of shake this very common accent. So I love that in the film, Emma's mother, who, as we were talking about, has this very kind of spot on Irish Liverpool accent, is constantly there to kind of remind you of Emma's like background, that she'll bring up these kind of weird scenarios that are kind of not fit for this situation. And Emma always kind of turns to her mother like, we don't talk about this now.
Yeah.
Which I love.
She never stops talking. She's a really funny character as a kind of counterpoint to all of these other figures. And yeah, she serves to kind of ground Emma and also cover for the fact that Vivian Leigh can't do an accent.
She kind of tries it in like the first like 5 minutes. She kind of does this almost like Audrey Hepburn, Eliza Doolittle sort of thing.
I was thinking that right at the beginning, it's very not bloody likely, I shall take a taxi. And it's very like overdone and ridiculous. And then she quite quickly like settles into the character and stops doing the kind of fake, not right, not like the performance of it. She's so bad at faking it. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's almost as if like someone behind the scenes was like, look, Vivian, you can't do this. You need to give up.
Just stop trying. Just don't do it. Let's talk about collecting and the way that the men in this film treat Emma. I think there's something really interesting in the way that she sort of announces, he sold you antiques, paintings, and among the bric-a-brac, a certain Emma Hart, when she's having this kind of first conversation with Hamilton. You said something really interesting when we were talking about this in terms of the sort of like sexual politics of this film and the power dynamics that are here. Would you like to elaborate on that?
Yeah, my kind of big theory that I was thinking about this kind of idea of kind of woman ends up with an older man who has this kind of paternalistic figure that we kind of vilify them for. And like the comparison I draw is with Anna Nicole Smith,
which is such a brilliant like galaxy brain take that I didn't see it at first, and then as soon as I thought about it, I was like, oh my god, yes.
It's an interesting thing as well, because I'm obsessed with Emma Hamilton, and when I was younger I was obsessed with Anna Nicole Smith because I thought she was like this incredibly glamorous person. But there's like a really interesting comparison to be made about this kind of perceived like lower class woman who marries an older man who is vilified for it. But when you think about it, it's if you are, and this is what they talk about in the You're Wrong About podcast about Anna Nicole Smith, which I recommend, is this idea that we vilify a woman for wanting security. Like if you are, I mean, Emma Hamilton is like 20 when she goes to Naples. If an older man is promising you security in a life, they are kind, they are offering you a life that you would never have, of course you're going to take it. But the kind of apparent vilification of that you must have been a gold digger or a social climber or things like that. There are these really interesting comparisons, especially when you think about later in life, when Emma Hamilton is kind of in London after William Hamilton dies, things like her performing in social circles was seen as very kind of uncouth. Anna Nicole Smith's TV show was seen as very kind of not classy, and it becomes very exploitative, and kind of similar happens with Emma Hamilton. They both get vilified for putting on weight as they become older.
Yeah.
Their family relationships are kind of put on blast. So I think there's kind of an interesting dichotomy and kind of interesting comparison between like the way we treat these kind of like celebrity beauties.
Completely. Yeah, and I mean, thinking about this, like, so many of the things about Emma Hamilton's life form very tidy parallels with the kind of vilified women of the 90s noughties in a really interesting way. And I think that there's a lot of room for kind of rehabilitation and reevaluation within that. I think we tend to not think about figures from the kind of more distant past in that way because they aren't around to defend themselves now. And we've seen this real kind of moment of reckoning with the treatment of women in mass media, and particularly the kind of fame machine and the way that that mistreats young women. And I think it's so interesting to try and understand the way that is something with a very deep history. And I'm not trying to say that like ah, yes, Charles Greville and William Hamilton are basically exactly like the tabloids in passing this woman around or whatever. Like, that's a very clunky and heavy-handed comparison to make. But I think that there is something in the way that feminine, kind of young feminine beauty is commodified. But then as soon as you try and, like, own that commodity for yourself, you become a subject of ridicule. And it's so interesting to me to put these more contemporary experiences in a historical context and find that kind of like sense of affinity. Obviously, the last episode on the podcast was about Marie Antoinette, and like, which is an amazing film that does something really similar to this, in that it's trying to sort of understand like a historical figure through a contemporary parallel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, like, this is my personal sort of thing, but I think it would be so interesting to see a contemporary version of this story, because the way that Emma is represented in this film is very much kind of tinted by the attitudes of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be really interesting to kind of, not that I want her to get the sort of like girl boss of history reinvention that everyone else seems to be going through right now, but I would really like to see a more nuanced understanding of her biography, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, this film is a war propaganda film dressed up as a romance. Whereas, yeah, if you had something like along the lines of when we had a few years ago with Scandalous Lady W, which was kind of looking at the lens of what happened with Seymour Worsley and her divorce. I think Emma Hamilton is like rife for like a mini series or something that actually looks at her. Because the one thing I thought when I was watching this film is she doesn't do an attitudes once.
She doesn't do an attitude, and I was so disappointed. She's constantly talking about how she's going to dance at these parties and people are going to adore her and love her and all of those things, but they never actually show her doing that. And she goes to the Queen of Naples and she gets sort of political favors and things like that, but again, that completely happens off screen.
Mm-hmm.
And we never see her either being a performer or like a political figure. We only ever see her kind of talking about it and being the good lover. And it's really interesting the way that her like biography is edited to fit this very specific narrative that they have in mind of sort of Nelson as the great hero and everyone making these sacrifices for the sake of Britain.
Mm-hmm.
But it means that she never does an attitude, and it's so annoying. I was like so excited. I was desperate for that to happen, or for at least like more engagement with the way that she was sort of an artist in her own right. And we don't see it. They're constantly talking about her going to dance lessons. Could Vivien Leigh dance? This is the question that I have. Maybe she was a terrible dancer. Does she dance in Gone with the Wind? It's been so long since I've seen that film.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, right. Well, there we go. Clearly Vivien Leigh couldn't dance.
Vivien Leigh couldn't dance. There's the takeaway from this. Or sing, because she was also like a trained opera singer.
Right. She's a total performer. And we never see any of that. It's interesting. I had another thought, and again, this is just turning up into us like finding analogues and contemporaries. The fact that this is a 1940s film, the fact that she is shown as a sort of a married woman slash potentially a divorcee. Obviously, she's kind of separated from William Hamilton towards the end of his life. According to the film, they are shown as being very estranged by the time that he dies. I kept thinking of Wallace Simpson in the context of this kind of idea of the like the woman who influences the man who's supposed to be the leader of the nation. And she is treated very, very differently. I think the fact that she's British and that her kind of ultimate service is to England gives her a bit of a free pass. The idea that she's sort of a good muse and inspiration to Nelson gives her a bit more kind of leeway in that. But yeah, the idea that she is kind of like a politically influential figure, but we never see her doing that. And she's never shown as being sort of domineering, and it's always cancelled out by her being sort of very sweet and flighty, is so interesting to me in terms of the power that she's allowed to have even within the world of this film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like she has this power, but it's always in service of Nelson. She's never shown as telling him what to do or telling William what to do. And her kind of relationship, particularly with Maria Carolina of Naples, is one that's very much like a friendship. And we know that her and Maria Carolina had this incredibly close bond. I'm pretty sure Emma was there like when one of her children died. Like they had this incredibly close friendship. So it's interesting that this film kind of touches on it but never fully explores it and kind of fully lets her own the fact that she was kind of a diplomat as much as William was. And I think that in itself is something that's still fairly recent a discussion. I mean, I know it was one of the things that was brought out in the Maritime Museum exhibition a few years ago, was very much saying, like, no, she is working as much of a diplomat. I mean, she is the reason why Nelson got those troops. And in the film, it kind of treats it as like, oh, well, this was easy for me. Like, of course, I'll help you.
Yeah, right.
Again, it's interesting that you draw that comparison to Ola Simpson of, like, she was very much like this dominating, like, negative influence, whereas Emma Hamilton is only ever in service to the men of Britain, I guess you could say.
Yeah. And it's always presented that, like, she doesn't take a political interest or anything until she's sort of inspired by Nelson's plight, and she's doing it sort of for the good of the nation. And she doesn't even know his name when she goes to get the troops from the Queen. She just does it because it's the right thing to do.
And she doesn't even know about the war. She, like, says to William, she doesn't even know about the war. She's like, you need to tell me about this. And she, like, barely knows who Napoleon is. Like,
yeah. But that gives Hamilton an opportunity to talk about an insane ambition that is attacking Europe, and how Britain is fighting alone with no allies and standing against this evil force from continental Europe. And it's very clunky.
It is the most hilarious monologue, because, like, she turns it and then the, like, dramatic music, like, goes to 180, and, like, the tone of William's voice is very, like, reverent. And yeah, it's just, it's the most, like, when you know the context that this is effectively a war propaganda film, it makes it, like, everything clicks, because it's just, it's like this tyrant that's taking over Europe, and we stand alone and have to fight him as British people. And yeah, I wrote in our notes, you could get really drunk if you drank every time this film silently played Rule Britannia in the background. Like, it's about six times that you're just doing something, like, something is happening, and the tune of Rule Britannia is just, like, slowly playing in the background.
Yeah. Or just, like, any of these other sort of naval marches and things like that. And I like, the Navy doesn't march, but you know what I mean? That as he's giving this speech, you can sort of feel it, like, fade out, and the British flag sort of fades in the background, and it's this moment of sort of, like, stirring propaganda. And it's really interesting that they choose this as the story to use as their kind of stirring propaganda, because they're trying to dress it up as this kind of beautiful love story. But it has this kind of tragic end, which we know is coming because of the introduction of the film.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, we're dealing with all these incredibly heavy-handed parallels between Napoleon and Hitler. And it's just exhausting.
And they feel so strange, because, like, you're expecting this. I mean, the film is titled Lady Hamilton, or That Hamilton Woman, so you're expecting this film to be entirely about her, and then you end up with these, like, extended scenes that are just about the Napoleonic War, particularly the end when Nelson dies at Trafalgar. That scene goes on for, like, half an hour, and there's, like, very little discussion of Emma until, like, right at the end when he's dying. And you're just like, I thought this was a film about their relationship and not the Napoleonic War.
Right, completely. I have to say, there are some really interesting points where they're sort of talking about, like, the Napoleonic Wars as this parallel. And one of the things that I wrote down in our notes was, you know, now it's Egypt and tomorrow it may be India. And that idea of this kind of creeping threat is really interesting in the background. It doesn't feel real in the film, though. Like, the threat of a French invasion feels just, like, so disconnected from everything that's going on. And when they're in London, she keeps saying, you know, we lived in a dream in Naples, we lived in this beautiful dream. But it just feels very dislocated from reality at all times. Every so often, Nelson has to go and accept some kind of new honour, but you never actually get the sense that there is a real war going on, which I found really interesting and really funny, because, like, the Hamiltons essentially have to flee Naples. They're there through this, like, period of quite intense conflict. The King and Queen are involved in that. They're sort of essentially imprisoned in the palace for a while. Like, Emma is involved in all of this. She helps them sort of flee and take refuge with the British and things like that. And it's a really high stakes moment. Mm-hmm. And instead we just get told that, like, Nelson picked up a ship of Brits and that's it. It's like, what is going on here?
Yeah, I like to think that maybe it's like they didn't have the budget to, like, film that scene or something. Or
yeah,
it's just, yeah, it's a very strange, like, example of, like, we're not going to show this, but we're going to, there's so much exposition about the war that, yeah, it doesn't make ever feel like that's happening. And yeah, I think part of that is because obviously the kind of, you're viewing the war through Emma, who kind of is shown to think of it slightly frivolously, even though she doesn't. So it's kind of, instead we just get these moments of like peril between Emma and Nelson, and kind of, and those like key moments of their like kind of relationship instead. Just kind of a weird tactic, but yeah, because if it was, but because they have these kind of discussions, it always seems like, yeah, it's, as I say, it's a war propaganda film dressed up as a romance.
Yeah, and that, I was really surprised actually that they spend so much sort of time on the battle at the end when they could have had a moment with Emma sort of at the heart of the conflict. And that was when it was really like, okay, this isn't actually about her. You've given it that title because that will make people go and see the film. But it doesn't have that. She's not really the main character in a lot of ways. At one point, Nelson storms into a room and yells that you cannot make peace with dictators, which was just, again, very, very clunky. I just feel so... This is such an interesting choice of conflict to make your propaganda film about.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that there were already kind of existing comparisons between Napoleon and Hitler in popular media, but it is a weird one, right? I'm not
So it's largely around to do with like the censors and things that like, so around the time Churchill says that there needs to be kind of like pro-Britain films and these things. But because of the censorship and things like that, they couldn't outright make like propaganda films.
Right.
So this was their kind of way of being like, okay, well, we can make this, but we have to kind of underhandedly dress it up this way. And obviously they were trying to kind of market it to America. So then they have these kind of, there's lots of parallels to be drawn between the kind of, I mean, this is the period when so many of these kind of big budget historical epics are being made. And frankly, I want more of them because I love these kind of films. So the comparison I drew was to the 1930s Marie Antoinette film, which starred Norma Shearer. There's lots of really interesting things. Like some of the costumes are very similar. The way that it frames kind of Nelson and Emma and William Hamilton is very similar to the way that the 1930s Marie Antoinette draws between like Louis, Marie and Fersen, because that film is like a romance between Marie Antoinette and Count Fersen. So there's lots of really similar things. I think one of the dresses that Emma wears looks so similar to one of the ones Norma Shearer wears.
Interesting.
So there's like interesting comparisons that I think, and you can tell that this is like a British film because it's not, it's clearly trying to be these kind of big like budget MGM films. I really wish this film had been filmed in colour because I think to see the colours of the costumes would have been really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, the sets are amazing.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I thought was most incredible reading about this film is that it was like they built the sets. They just built these fucking palaces. It's incredible. I love it.
And the scale of them is massive.
It's so cool. Oh my God, it's insane. And like, obviously this is all happening on a soundstage, probably in Ealing somewhere. but they've built these incredible sets, and to see the kind of like work that goes into it is amazing. To see the costuming and things like that is really interesting. Emma's costumes are best when she's dressed as a painting,
mm-hmm.
and when there are these very clear references. Once they're in England, her costumes kind of go off the rails and she suddenly has a very 40s updo, which was quite funny and quite jarring. And Fanny Nelson, who we will get onto, is always dressed like a 1930s school mom. And I hated it. But one thing I thought was really interesting was that the court in Naples is incredibly like frilly and frou-frou and loud and chaotic, and people are always like singing and screaming and there are always children everywhere and it's like really intense. And the costumes in particular in the court scenes are really over the top. They've mm-hmm. got very wide skirts, they've got lots of detailing and kind of ornament to their dress. Emma is always dressed very simply by comparison.
Mm-hmm.
There is one scene where she's in a kind of like gold lamé, black velvet getup, which is amazing. But she has a very kind of like simple beauty to the way that she's styled.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there's probably something going on here about those danged Italians and their frivolity. But it was really interesting to see the kind of way that she's presented as being very pared back. But then in comparison to Fanny Nelson, she's completely over the top and ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting. I think one of the interesting things about this film is, like, comparatively, the cast is actually very small. You don't get really any other kind of... She doesn't really meet any other, like, British diplomats or anything like that. There's, like, two where she meets, like, a countess So what I would have loved is kind of a discussion around her and like other kind of people, because I mean, British people visiting Naples had a lot to say about her, particularly women didn't yes. like her and had a lot of very nasty things to say about her. So I think, yeah, it would have been interesting if they had included maybe like her meeting a British Duke or Duchess or something like that. I know Elizabeth Vassall Fox like wrote in her diaries very negative things about her. And yeah, this one of my favourite kind of discussions about her, I say favourite because it's not very nice, is when she's doing one of her attitudes with William Hamilton's, like an actual ancient base. And one of the observers, I can't remember who writes the letter, but she says that like William looks really scared because obviously she's got an ancient base. And this woman says, and she like has this beautiful face and she opens her mouth and out comes this, "Don't worry, I won't break your jug." And it, like, she writes it phonetically as well, and it's like really funny because she's clearly being like, look at this absolute like commoner. So it would have been really funny to see like if they did a comparison with like her costumes, because like one of the things that always happens during a time is that she kind of outlived her means. So she clearly had a lot of things like dresses and nice houses and things.
Yeah, absolutely. Should we talk about the sort of part of the film that takes place back in England, and particularly the way that Fanny Nelson is presented? I thought it was really interesting that the film is just so cruel to her.
Mm-hmm.
By all accounts, she wasn't a great person, and neither was Nelson. None of these people were very good people. Like, we shouldn't be admiring or adoring any of them. But it was very interesting to me that in order to, again, kind of further this narrative of the great love affair, she has to be a stone cold bitch.
Yeah, the way that like Fanny Nelson is portrayed as being kind of like this old, mean, dowdy woman
with her dickhead son.
Yeah, with her son who's just like a knobhead for like 2 seconds and then you never see it again. It's funny, and like they have all these encounters where they're talking to each other and she's just incredibly bitchy, which I mean, if your husband's having an affair, you probably would be, but it's funny how yeah, and even, it's funny as well, because even William Hamilton is shown as being kind of quite mean about it. There's like a discussion where he says, "Oh, my statues won't run out on a sailor." When in fact, like William Hamilton, they very much lived like as a throuple, because like all accounts say that William Hamilton was actually very fond of Nelson and wanted them to stay, like him to stay in there. And I mean, the man was like in his late 60s at this point. He probably knew that his wife is not gonna be entirely kept by his attention. So it's funny how like they have to make the spouses mean.
There's a sense of practicality to that as well, that you very much get the impression with William Hamilton that he's trying to make sure that she will be looked after he dies, which is something that Nelson completely fails to do for her. And he sort of promises that she will be taken care of, but the state refuses to acknowledge her with any kind of pension after his death and things like that. Whereas with William, you do at least get the sense that he recognises that her life will be difficult after he's gone. And I thought that was an interesting thing, that we don't really see the sort of power dynamics of their relationship, and the fact that once she is widowed, her position in society is very, very different. But Fanny Nelson is just... she's a nurse to Nelson's father. She's just cold and unpleasant. And she's so mean about Emma continually. And it was interesting to me that the film didn't try and redeem her, that she has to kind of fulfill this role in the narrative. And not that I think she's worthy of redemption, but that it was striking to sort of see the choices that were made for the narrative in order to further this kind of like great romance.
Yeah, they kind of had to invent this kind of antagonist when they get back to England, when really the antagonist was just the society that they were living in. So it's interesting that, she's kind of this kind of primary antagonist for like 45 minutes and then she disappears and doesn't get mentioned again, because she goes off back to Norfolk and kind of lives her, says, "I'll never give you a divorce," and goes off to Norfolk and kind of lives her life there.
Can we talk a little bit about what happens to sort of Emma's legacy? There's a really interesting thing about the way that she's kind of vilified during her own lifetime as well, but that particularly she becomes a kind of figure of ridicule, especially after Nelson dies and she's left as this sort of punchline.
There's so many cartoons, particularly around like the later part of her life, where obviously she kind of has the classic thing that, again, when you think about this is exactly what happens to Anna Nicole Smith and other people, kind of young beauties let themselves go, in inverted commas, and that becomes a source of ridicule, that she becomes overweight, she becomes addicted to alcohol. There are these cartoons of her as this kind of comedic fat woman figure, which happens during her lifetime, which is horrible, but particularly after her death, well, particularly after Nelson's death, it becomes very much, the morals of the time is very much that we cannot possibly celebrate this military hero who skips out on his wife. So of course we have to invent a bad guy here. So she very quickly becomes this kind of, I think a biography of Nelson quite after, soon after he dies, kind of calls her this siren that tempts him, and this temptress. It's interesting that the working title of this film was The Enchantress.
I did not know about that. I think that's such a fascinating choice.
It's an interesting thing because that's not the narrative of the film.
No. And I mean, I wonder if there must have been like an earlier draft or something out there where she is more of a femme fatale, but she isn't an enchantress. She's like very sweet and very wholesomely in love with him. And he's in love with her. And that makes for an interesting moral dilemma within the film.
Yeah. And it's an interesting thing that so quickly after they die that they kind of have to vilify their relationship for the sake of celebrating Nelson. I mean, to this day, you still see Nelson as kind of this military hero in Britain, slightly problematically, but a slight understatement, but yeah. So it's like, you cannot possibly celebrate this man who gave his life to Britain if he's skipping out on his wife with someone who was a perceived sex worker, sort of narrative. So it takes a long time before people, it takes like 100-odd years before people actually start to think of her as a person almost.
yeah, and kind of within that there's this, I mean, the title thing is really interesting, the fact that it's initially called The Enchantress, the fact that it's then released as Lady Hamilton, but now you mostly see it referred to as That Hamilton Woman, which is a completely different vibe of a title, and comes from a letter that we see Josiah writing. Josiah is Horatio Nelson's stepson, from Fanny Nelson's first husband, and you see him writing a letter to her about that Hamilton woman won't leave him alone. And it's interesting that that was one of the titles that's then used, I believe, when it's released in the States, that there's this very different emphasis on her as a kind of like gal about town getting things done, and I don't know how to describe this character and the way that she's presented, because this is also an incredibly chaste film. Like it's deeply unhorny despite the fact that it's all about their kind of fierce passions, and they include Horatia, the unsubtly named daughter of Emma Hamilton and Horatio Nelson.
Yeah, my favourite thing about Horatia is that, like, during her lifetime, they never said, like, it takes a long time before they, like, publicly announce that she's, like, Nelson's daughter, and for a long time they don't say that she's Emma Hamilton's daughter. But it's like, you named her Horatia. Like, it's, like, the least subtle name. And they have a point in the film where they're like, oh, well, we can't take her. And it's like, with a name like that, who is guessing who her father is?
Like, seriously.
One of my favorite things about the film is, like, you can absolutely tell that it's made like in 1940s Britain, because it's like the least horny film about these two people that had like this very tumultuous love affair. There's like three kissing scenes in the whole film. My favorite part is, like, it's kind of very well documented that when Emma goes onto the ship after Nelson returns to Britain and she sees him like missing an arm and he's like lost half his teeth, she like falls upon him, she's so like overcome, and in the film she's just like, oh, you've been hard done by.
Yeah, completely. I mean, obviously they're not going to make Laurence Olivier unattractive, and they keep just sort of changing their minds about whether he wears an eye patch or not, and like there are several scenes where he clearly has two functioning eyes because they can't like commit to the fact that he's been wounded.
And one very subtle, which is quite scar on his head. Like,
funny. So funny. so funny. But he is presented as kind of continually this very powerful masculine figure in a way that is quite different to the reality. And that's obviously like the vanity of actors, but it does make it quite funny that you have these two people who were married in real life by this point and who had a kind of similarly intense and tumultuous relationship where I believe when they met, they were both still married to their previous spouses. And they have this quite like public sort of sexual relationship. Mm-hmm. And they work together on all these films, and there's a lot of discussion over how Vivian Leigh might be using him to further her career and how she's not good enough for these parts, but she only wants them because Lawrence is also in the film. And there's a lot around her kind of treatment in the media during their marriage that has really interesting parallels with this film.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very... She kind of sits in this very weird kind of Hollywood persona, particularly in this kind of like dual British American kind of aspect where even though she was a dramatic actress, like Laurence Olivier is very much seen as the kind of premier Shakespearean actor and she's a film star almost, which is so interesting because she acted on the stage just as much and by all accounts was a better actress. Laurence Olivier couldn't do funny or to save his life. Like, if you watch The Prince and the Showgirl, like, he's not funny at all.
And she is quite funny in this. Like, there are moments where she's genuinely, like, very hilarious, and she does a great job of switching between the sort of, like, flighty bimbo and kind of smart and commanding and getting things done. And it's really... It's charming, especially the earlier scenes in the film where she's very young. She's very compelling to watch. And, yeah, it's lovely. And then you've got this kind of weird framing narrative that, you know, she's a fallen woman now and she's old and everything's tragic. But, like, the film does at least let you enjoy the lighter parts of her life in a way that I do appreciate.
Yeah, it's kind of... It's really interesting to me that, like, her final thing she says is that there's no after. That, like, after Nelson died, there was, like, nothing for her. Which was an interesting way to like frame it. And that literally is how the film ends. Like she's just in this prison and she's like, there is no after. And then it's done. Whereas I don't know, there's kind of, you never really get like fully, I think because the film is so chaste, you never really fully get engaged with Emma and Nelson's relationship. So that when he dies, you're just kind of like, oh, okay. When actually like his final words were like, he wanted Emma to, he'd like made them give Emma his hair. She has the coat that he dies in. Like one of like the saddest things about Emma Hamilton's life that I always go back to is that she was given Nelson's coat and it was like the last thing she pawned when she had no money. And it's interesting that the Seduction and Celebrity exhibition had that as the very last object in the exhibition that you saw and discussed that about this must have been like the most important thing she owned. And it was the very last thing she parted with. So, like, they had such, like, an really important, like, relationship. And it's, like, the film kind of, I don't think, does as much justice as they could have. Especially when you consider, like, Vivian Leigh and Laurence Olivier, like, when they're together. Like, the scene when there's the fireworks and he's like, well, I've kissed you through two centuries now. Like, that is, like, so romantic. And, like, the film, could do so much more with it.
Yeah, the scene where they're in the tavern as well, they sneak off from the opera and just go to some, like, shitty little Naples dive bar. And they're both supposedly in disguise, but she's wearing, like, a glitter lace shawl and he's in, like, full naval getup and an eye patch. And it's like, this isn't subtle. Because they've just come from the opera. And it's like, this is so unsubtle. But there's this incredibly funny scene where she imitates everyone who would have been at the dinner party. And so she does her little impersonation of the Queen of Naples and the King of Naples and William Hamilton. And then she imitates him. And she's, you know, Nelson happy, completely blank face. Nelson thrilled, completely blank face. Nelson miserable, exactly the same face. And it's so funny. And it's just this really delightful little bit of comedy. And Laurence Olivier is just sitting opposite her like a plank of wood. But she is absolutely like showing this really charming, really loving relationship. And then the film just kind of like doesn't do anything with it and immediately has the dickhead stepson come in and make a joke about how she's a whore. And it's so unpleasant, but it's interesting. Even though I hate it, I wanted this to be more of a romance and also
have more of the kind of like critical understanding of how their relationship was perceived at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I don't think those things are reconcilable, but it sort of sits between the two. Like, it's not an all-out romance. It's not an all-out social commentary. It's just kind of like, weird propaganda film.
Yeah, it's very like of its time in a way that like, mm-hmm. I don't know if there's many other films that are similarly strange.
Yeah.
We just clearly need also, like a 10 episode like mini series about Emma Hamilton's life, I think.
Completely. It's also, it's really long.
It's so long.
It's and so long. You, there it's are several 2 hours
It's one
long.
Of those films where there are several points when you think, is this finished? And like it's particularly like when they go back to London to up till Trafalgar, where like nothing happens but stuff happens. And you're just like, and the Battle of Trafalgar scene is like 20 minutes long and like
oh my God,
has
exhausting.
Very little discussion. And it's again one of these scenes where there's clearly like really heavy-handed metaphors about the World War II. And you're just thinking, why am I still discussing naval strategy? And this is a film about Emma Hamilton.
And the last bit of the sort of flashback sequence is Hardy saying, you know, England is safe from, you know, the seas are free once again and England is saved from invasion, and it's all about how Nelson's given his life for this great cause. And it's like, okay, we get it. Like, yeah, okay, that's fine. We get it. But in many ways, it's like a religiously detailed film because it has every sort of big event. Like, it hits all the notes. It has them at the opera. It has them at these concerts. It has them meeting and then not meeting and then all of these things. But it's just painfully slow. And I kind of appreciate the attention to detail, you know, of like, oh, they met and then they didn't see each other for ages. And then they had this kind of like golden period of love. But we never actually really see much of that. We just get a lot of exposition about it. And it just kind of clunks along. And I don't know, I really got my hopes up when I was like, okay, it's a film from 1941, so it's going to be like 80 minutes maximum, and it's a full 2 hours. And it's just really slow.
Yeah, this is how old Hollywood films get you, is you're like, oh, this will be a nice easy film, and then like all of a sudden you're watching like a 4-hour epic and you're like, what has happened?
Why am I here? How did I get here? I don't really know how I feel about this film because it's such a piece of like weirdo propaganda. It's kind of not actually about Emma Hamilton at all.
Yeah. And it's one of those films that in some ways
slightly misled.
It handles some things really well. Like, I feel like the first like 45 minutes to an hour is like amazing. But every so often, it's kind of impeded by the fact that every time you remember that this is a war propaganda film and they start talking about how we must give our selflessness to fighting for our nation, it kind of is a bit like, oh, shit.
I kind of just want a supercut of Vivian Leigh being hot and funny and charming and, like, get rid of the rest.
Yes. Just, yeah, it's, and like, when I was reading about this film for, because I had not seen this film for years, and I was reading in a book that apparently Stalin loved this film.
What the fuck?
Which is just, I don't know how to deal with that piece of information.
This is a piece of information that I cannot process. You've told me this already. I've seen it written down. And yet I just like every time I try and like force my brain to accept this fact, it just like spits it back out again. Like, I can't do it.
Imagine him sitting there and I don't understand. This film is just like a weird,
just having a great time, loving it. Absolutely just beside himself with delight. It's insane. It's absolutely insane. I cannot process this information. I simply refuse to do so.
Now I've shared it with everyone else to just be very confused.
Yeah. Did he watch a dub of it? Was it subtitled? How was it made available to him? Did he like, was it distributed widely?
Or did
like,
he think
what,
about
how
all
did
the
this
war?
Happen? What did he think about? Did he get the
did
metaphors?
He just like
did
Vivian
he
like... Leigh? Like, that's how right, I imagine right, it. Like... I just imagine he was like, you know what? Vivian Leigh's great. I'm going to watch this film.
Yeah. She's a hottie. Let's watch it. And it's just, I need to know. I need to know what the fuck is happening here. Every part of this is insane. Like, every single part of this, my brain just refuses to process this information.
I think after 2 hours of the film as well, your brain just refuses to compute anything else because you're just like, I've heard so much Rule Britannia is played so many times that my brain doesn't work anymore.
Heart of Oak, car our ships. Rah, rah, rah. England expects every man will do his duty. You, me, and Stalin in the Emma Hamilton fan club. I think we have to stop.
We've gotten to the point of our brains not working.
Would you recommend this film?
Yes and no. I think in a lot of ways it is. It's very fun. It's very of its time. I think it's one of those films that if you weren't someone who already like enjoyed kind of old Hollywood, like kind of, I say epic because it's only 2 hours, so it's not like a big kind of like Gone with the Wind epic. But if you're not someone that enjoys those films, I don't think you would like it. But I think as a capsule of this kind of like old, because they don't make like kind of historical biopics in the same way that they do back then. So it's very interesting for that. And I mean, we don't have really any other kind of film media of Emma Hamilton. So it's not like Marie Antoinette where we have like 30 films about her that you can watch. So it's kind of surprise. It's better than you kind of would expect. I think going into it, I was actually surprised by how like positive it is in a lot of respects. And it does treat a lot of the ideas, particularly like Emma Hamilton having agency in her life.
Yeah.
In a way that
completely. I was really surprised by that. I was really genuinely surprised by that. I think that I would have enjoyed this more had I not been sort of sitting and taking notes on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can watch the niceties with Vivian Leigh being funny and you can turn off when anyone's discussing the Napoleonic War.
Completely. Like, this feels to me like an absolute classic between Christmas and New Year film.
Yes, absolutely.
And I love it for that reason, but also sitting and watching it in intense focus for 2 hours has just completely scrambled my brain.
Yeah, it's very much one of those kind of films.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been an absolute delight.
Thank you for having me
back. We're going to have you back again, I think, pretty soon. Just we're going to talk about
cannot get rid of me.
Desiree and do more of these kind of like weirdo romantic historical films, which I just absolutely love. In the meantime, where can people find you?
I am on Twitter as @tinyhistorian. I'm also on Instagram as _tinyhistorian. And yeah, that's talk about work and other fangirling of Emma Hamilton and Napoleon and all those weird art things.
Amazing. This has been such a delight. Thank you so much for listening. We will be back next week with another episode. In the meantime, you can find us on Twitter @historyfriction and on Patreon @historicalfriction. And just send us nice opinions and thoughts wherever you want. Bye!